in the same way that a home buyer obtains a mortgage by pledging the collateral of the home against the loan. This practice gave rise to an army of corporate raiders, men such as Ron Perelman, Carl Icahn, T-Bone Pickens, and Nelson Peltz, who became rich selling junk bonds through Drexel Burnham to finance predatory raids on such Fortune 100 companies as TWA, Disney, Revlon, and Phillips Petroleum. So fearsome did Milken's reputation become that sometimes the mere rumor that a company might come under siege was enough to send it scrambling toward a defensive merger. Hostile takeovers became a hugely profitable business for Milken and Drexel. By 1986, Bannon's first full year on Wall Street, Milken had become Wall Street's most notorious villain, and Drexel Burnham its most profitable investment bank, clearing $545.5 million on revenues of $4 billion. More important for Bannon and Goldman Sachs, Milken and his army of raiders had struck terror in the hearts of the chief executives of America's finest corporations. "Everything in the Midwest was being raided by Milken," said Bannon. "It was like a firestorm." The attacks by Milken had a corollary effect on the companies he targeted. They needed help staving off the barbarians at the gates. This, too, created profitable new business opportunities. Goldman Sachs, not yet evolved into the money-grubbing vampire squid it would later become, was a white-shoe firm that wouldn't deign to represent corporate raiders in hostile takeover bids. Instead, Goldman developed a specialty in raid defense for blue-chip companies targeted by the likes of Drexel Burnham and First Boston. Bannon landed in the firm's mergers and acquisitions department, the SWAT team the companies called in to advise and protect them when the raiders came calling. Ensconced on the 23rd floor of Goldman's old headquarters at 85 Broad Street, Bannon spent his first few years at Goldman working 100-hour weeks and clocking in every day except Christmas. You'd get a call at 7 a.m. on Sunday from a partner wanting to go over your work schedule for the day, he said. Goldman's M&A department was led by Jeff Boise, the fanatically driven mastermind of the mega deals, as the New York Times dubbed him, and Mike Overlock, who had just served in a long-range reconnaissance patrol in the Vietnam War. "I was just a junior grundoon," said Bannon, "but we got to work with Hank Paulson, the future Treasury Secretary, who was the new business guy in the Chicago office and the most intense guy in humanity. It was a grueling life, but one that he loved. The environment was intense, but the camaraderie was amazing," he said. "It was like being in the Navy, in the wardroom of a ship." At the time Bannon arrived, Goldman Sachs was the last major partnership on Wall Street. "Goldman then was a very different place than it is today," he said. "A very small partnership and an enormously conservative place at the time." Goldman's caution was dictated by its ownership structure. Not only did the partners have their own money on the line, but they held unlimited liability if an investment went wrong. "If Milken came in and did a raid," said Bannon, "and you were going in to tell the board of directors that you could get a better price, it was like going to argue before the Supreme Court. You had better be able to back it up, because if it turned out you were wrong, shareholders would come back and sue the partnership for bad information." These circumstances instilled a rigor that Bannon, like Michael Lewis and other Wall Street veterans turned critics, believes was lost when investment banks became publicly traded companies that felt free to gamble with shareholders' money. "Goldman in the 80s was like a priesthood," said Bannon, "a monastic experience where you worked all the time but were incredibly dedicated to client services, to building and growing companies." The firm thought of itself as long-term greedy, meaning that it was devoted to the well-being of its clients, who, over years and decades, would reward that devotion by giving Goldman their business. "It was a calling, like joining the Jesuits," he said, "to build and grow companies." Somebody once told me, "The river of history runs deep through Goldman's M&A department because you're at the forefront of helping the country restructure into a post-industrial economy." We believed that. Yet even as Bannon was imbibing the lore of Goldman's high priests, the firm was headed down a path that would destroy this careful balance of interests when the partners cashed out their stakes in Goldman's public offering a decade later. Without the restraining force of their liability, Goldman began to emulate the behavior of other publicly traded investment banks, whose collective excesses ultimately precipitated the 2008 financial crisis. Cut to 20 years later, Bannon said, and Wall Street is a casino that taxpayers have to bail out. I soured on Wall Street for the same reason everybody else did. The American taxpayer was forced to cut mook deals to bail out Wall Street. It was totally unfair. Even in the 80s, long before Wall Street's collapse, Bannon harbored an admiration for the villain whom he and his colleagues were often matched up against in his early Goldman days. Milken, a Jew who wore an ill-fitting toupee, was initially shunned and later despised by the old money firms with their WASP lineage and culture of restraint. But it was Milken who ultimately prevailed by storming their fortresses and upending their businesses. Eventually, they wised up and began doing what Milken had been doing all along, taking big stakes in the companies for themselves. Bannon had the brains and the social intelligence to pass as a Harvard preppy and a Goldman whiz kid, but deep down, he identified more with Milken, a swashbuckler and rogue who struck fear in his adversaries. The strengths that Milken had, the aggressiveness, the creativity, the hard work, those are all traits Steve admires, said a former Goldman colleague. Whether he recognized it or not, Bannon was better suited to the other side. Later on, when Milken went to prison for insider trading, Bannon did a deal to roll up one of his companies. After Milken was freed and had begun rehabilitating his image, Bannon appeared as a featured speaker at one of his conferences. More than anything, Milken was a kind of spirit animal who fired the imagination and showed just how far you could go if you stopped worrying about appearances and seized opportunity. His lesson was never forgotten. If you took Michael Milken and Drexel in 1985 and teleported them from Wall Street to Washington, D.C. in 2015, what you'd wind up with would look a lot like Stephen Bannon and Breitbart News, a band of outsiders laying siege to a comfortable, fattened, and vulnerable establishment. Two big things were going on at Goldman Sachs in the late 1980s. The globalization of world capital markets meant that size suddenly mattered. Everyone realized that the firm, a private partnership, would eventually have to go public to keep pace with its competitors. Bankers also could see that the Glass-Steagall Act, separating commercial and investment banking, was going to fall, setting off a flurry of acquisitions. Young bankers like Bannon were trained to be generalists. In the world to come, specialists would command a premium. After spending a year in Goldman's London office, Bannon shipped out to Los Angeles to learn the media and entertainment businesses. Throughout the 1980s, big media companies were expanding and becoming more valuable. Some of this was due to the growing audience for TV shows and movies, but it was also because the federal government under Reagan had relaxed antitrust restrictions, which meant that the media and entertainment industries, like the oil and gas, retail clothing, and pharmaceutical industries, were taking a page from Wall Street and embarking on an orgy of mergers and acquisitions. Some of these media mergers, such as Time Inc.'s $14 billion merger with Warner Communications in 1989 to create the world's largest entertainment conglomerate, were defensive in nature, intended to make companies large enough that they wouldn't fall prey to corporate raiders. Others were strategic acquisitions, like General Electric's 1985 takeover of RCA and its NBC division for $6.3 billion, a deal Bannon worked on for Goldman in its capacity as an advisor to GE. A lot of people were coming from outside buying media companies, he said. There was just huge consolidation going on. The frenzy to acquire TV and film companies posed a particular challenge for investment banks like Goldman Sachs that profited by facilitating these deals. Hollywood movie studios were notoriously fickle, boom-and-bust affairs, whose value was often tethered to whether or not they had recently churned out blockbuster hits. A steadier source of value, at least in theory, was contained in the vast libraries of movie titles many studios controlled, because there would always be an audience for classics such as Gone with the Wind and The Godfather, and therefore television channels willing to pony up to broadcast them. The trouble was how to value these films. They were closer to intellectual property than to tangible assets, such as broadcast networks. Most investors preferred hard assets that could be easily measured. Factories, airplanes, real estate, and avoided things like movie studios and film libraries, which were much harder to price with precision. Bannon and some colleagues figured out how to do it. By drawing on hard data such as VHS cassette sales and television ratings, they came up with a model to value intellectual property in the same way as physical assets. Removing this obstacle made it as easy to value Columbia Pictures as it was to value American Airlines or Chrysler Motors, which only added to the Hollywood merger stampede. Bannon possessed a gift, a kind of X-ray vision, that let him walk into a studio and quickly suss out not just top-line numbers, but the whole schema, how the interlocking pieces fit together and what they were really worth. He understood the math completely, said a colleague. He could walk in, take one look, and say, "You're fucked. You're going bankrupt." Rather than keep working for a salary, Bannon and a fellow Goldman vice president quit in 1990 to form their own boutique investment bank in Beverly Hills that became Bannon and Co. Staked to $100 million in financing from a Japanese trading house, Bannon started a production company, installed the ousted former head of Universal Pictures, Tom Mount, as president, and executive produced Sean Penn's 1991 directorial debut, The Indian Runner. Although the film's cast included Dennis Hopper, Benicio del Toro, and Viggo Mortensen, it was a box office flop, grossing just $191,125 in the United States and Canada. Mount, who worked closely with Bannon and generally liked him, recalled a figure of swashbuckling grandiosity who would be entirely recognizable to someone who knew him today. He was constantly telling stories about great warriors of the past, like Attila the Hun, people who had slain empires, Mount said. It's one thing to be interested in the triumphs of military history. It's another thing to obsess over them. Victory at all costs is a dangerous way to look at the world. The Wild West atmosphere of Wall Street in the 80s produced no small amount of chaos and financial carnage. The prestige of owning blue-chip companies, the clashing egos of big-time financiers, and the enormous fortunes to be made attracted a rogues gallery of ambitious frauds and hucksters who managed to blow up or bankrupt a whole roster of brand-name companies. Hollywood, with its star power and showbiz glamour, proved to be, if anything, an even greater lure for ambitious charlatans longing for fame and riches. The debt-fueled takeover of Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer Studios in 1990, followed soon after by its spectacular collapse, still stands as the era-defining example of reckless stupidity, and the one that made Bannon rich. In 1990, after bids from Ted Turner and Rupert Murdoch fell through, MGM's owner Kirk Kerkorkian sold the historic studio to a shady, little-known Italian financier named Giancarlo Paretti for $1.3 billion. Paretti, a producer of low-budget foreign movies, had started out in life as a petty crook in Sicily, where he earned a rap sheet for securities fraud, check-kiting, and conspiring to commit bodily harm. Yet by the mid-80s, he had gained control of an Italian insurance company and hotel and real estate firms, at which point a Roman Catholic organization asked him to supervise the production of Bernadette, a biographical film about a French peasant girl in the 1850s who saw visions of the Virgin Mary and became a saint. Paretti, enthralled by the movie business, arranged to buy the film's nearly bankrupt distributor, Canon Group, with a $250 million loan from the French bank Crédit Lyonnais. Upon arriving in Hollywood, Paretti promptly reinvented himself as a Rolls-Royce-driving movie mogul, all the while cooking up a blizzard of bribes, shell companies, and fraudulent loans. He bought a yacht. He flew to the Vatican to screen Bernadette for Pope John Paul II. Finally, after bribing assorted high-level Crédit Lyonnais officials, Peretti persuaded the bank to lend him more than $1 billion to buy MGM from Krikorian, pledging the studio's film library as collateral and hiding some of the loans behind shell companies. On the day the deal closed, Peretti threw a champagne party in MGM's offices that featured a live 400-pound lion. Then he set about looting the place, firing top financial executives, installing his 21-year-old daughter in their place, and, as court records would later reveal, placing a harem of his mistresses on the MGM payroll. By then, Crédit Lyonnais had quietly become the largest lender in Hollywood, funding not only Peretti's MGM gambit, but dozens of independent production studios as well. Within 8 months, all of it came crashing down. MGM defaulted on its payments to several creditors, who attempted to force the studio into bankruptcy. Alerted to Peretti's criminal history, the SEC and FBI started snooping around. Crédit Lyonnais' fraudulent loans were exposed. Peretti was arrested in Los Angeles on a French warrant charging him with embezzlement and defrauding the French bank, indicted by a Delaware grand jury on perjury and evidence tampering charges, and slapped with civil fraud charges by the SEC for misrepresenting Crédit Lyonnais loans as equity investments in the purchase of MGM. Peretti and two associates eventually settled the charges. The French government, humiliated, fired Crédit Lyonnais' chief executive, and the bank foreclosed on MGM, having lost somewhere in the neighborhood of $1 billion. Even as it teetered on the brink of its own bankruptcy, Crédit Lyonnais suddenly found itself in possession of MGM and 30-odd independent production houses that it had no earthly idea how to value or sell. Bannon and his partners were brought in to clean up the wreckage. "It was a disaster," said Scott Vorce, Bannon's HBS classmate who became a partner in his new firm. Every one of these companies was flailing. As Bannon and Vorce pored over the books, it soon became clear that the production houses were all going to go bust, a state of affairs that earned them the ignominious industry nickname, the Dirty 30. Seduced by the glamour of the Hollywood lifestyle, corrupt French bankers had showered producers and distributors with more money than they knew what to do with. But the bankers never grasped the economics of the movie business. The industry's focus was on getting films made and collecting producers' fees, the glitzy stuff of stars, directors, red carpet premieres, and variety headlines. For investors, however, the real money was made on the back end, in licensing the rights to broadcast and distribute those films in the United States and abroad. In the same way that a collateralized debt obligation is the sum of hundreds of individual mortgages, the real value of a film is the outstanding sum of its individual licensing deals. Both products can quickly ruin investors who don't understand them. When Bannon dug into the financials, he discovered that many of the assets owned by MGM and the Dirty 30 were toxic and had little value. "Hollywood is a terrible, tough business to make money in," said Vorce. "Because of Crédit Lyonnais, huge amounts of money were lent to outfits with terrible business plans. All these producers and distributors were running around, and the bankers were all hanging out with them in swanky Hollywood hotels. It was a complete disaster." Bannon loved it. "We got a ton of business," he said. "We were the only sane ones who knew what was going on." His firm represented the post-Peretti MGM management as it belatedly took stock of its assets, while providing the same services to the Dirty 30. Fortunately for Crédit Lyonnais, plenty of global media conglomerates still wanted to get into the film business. Now, however, with MGM's implosion having underscored the value of understanding precisely what it was that they were acquiring, they had the good sense to seek out expert advisors who could tell them. When PolyGram decided to get into the film business, it hired Bannon & Co. to advise it on the purchase of the Dirty 30 from Crédit Lyonnais. Then Seagram wanted into the business and bought PolyGram. Bannon & Co. advised PolyGram on the sale. When Seagram turned around and decided to sell those same assets, the company brought in the investment bankers who understood their value best. Bannon & Co. "We used to joke that we were like pilot fish," said Vorse. "We spent our lives at MGM, learned the microeconomics of the business, and sold the same properties again and again and again." In 1996, the story came full circle when Crédit Lyonnais sold MGM back to Kirk Kerkorkian. Bannon & Co. handled several other high-profile deals. They flew to Italy to advise Silvio Berlusconi, the founder of Fininvest and future prime minister, on the value of his firm's film library. They represented the Saudi businessman Prince Al-Walid bin Talal. They worked on the takeover of Orion Pictures by MGM. And in 1993, they represented Westinghouse Electric in selling its ownership stake of Castle Rock Entertainment, the film and TV production company behind Billy Crystal's films, to Turner Broadcasting, a deal that unexpectedly pulled Bannon into the entertainment industry and handed him a winning lottery ticket. Having failed in his quest to buy MGM 3 years earlier, Ted Turner was still itching to create an empire. "Turner was going to build this huge studio," Bannon said, "so we were negotiating the deal at the St. Regis Hotel in New York. As often happened with Turner, when it came time to actually close the deal, Ted was short of cash. Westinghouse wanted out. Bannon pleaded with them not to walk away from the bargaining table. We told them, 'You ought to take this deal. It's a great deal,' he said. And they go, 'If this is such a great deal, why don't you defer some of your cash fee and keep an ownership stake in a package of TV rights?'" Bannon had no interest in getting into the residuals business, but neither did Westinghouse. The company made clear that unless Bannon & Co. swapped its cash fee for residuals, the deal was off. "So, we took a residual," he said. In lieu of a full advisor's fee, the firm accepted a stake in 5 Castle Rock television shows, including one in its 3rd season that was regarded as the runt of the litter, Seinfeld. At the time, the show hadn't cracked the Nielsen Top 30. A year later, it became a hit. "We calculated what it would get us if it made it to syndication," said Bannon. "We were wrong by a factor of 5. The desire of large foreign banks to plunge into Hollywood did not abate, not even among French banks, who might have known better. But Société Générale was confident it wouldn't repeat the mistakes of Crédit Lyonnais, because in 1996, as part of a plan to move into the independent distribution business, it had struck a deal to acquire Bannon & Co. By the time the deal paid out, in 1998, Bannon was sitting pretty. Société Générale, not so much. The independent distribution business had dried up by then. No longer needing a day job, Bannon dabbled in minor Hollywood moguldom. He became an executive producer of movies, including Anthony Hopkins's 1999 Oscar-nominated Titus. He rolled up a succession of small media properties from, among others, Michael Milken, Terry Semel, and Doug Liman, the latter carrying residuals to Fox's primetime teen soap opera, The O.C. "Great intellectual property," Bannon boasted to Variety. "He loved doing deals," said Vorse. "He had his hands in everything. He invested in or served on the board of companies that made products ranging from homeopathic nasal spray to branded video games for Burger King. He met a hard-partying talent manager named Jeff Quatinetz, who had discovered the band Korn and managed the Backstreet Boys. Newly flush and eager for adventure, Bannon joined Quatinetz's new management outfit, The Firm, as a partner, and helped orchestrate its great coup, the acquisition of former Disney chief Michael Ovitz's company, Artist Management Group. Ovitz had spent $100 million building a behemoth he thought would conquer Hollywood, but AMG was hemorrhaging money. Selling to The Firm was a last-ditch bid to save face. Instead, Bannon showed up one day at Ovitz's Beverly Hills mansion to deliver a final humiliating blow, an offer for AMG of just $5 million, less than the value of Ovitz's home. "He didn't understand the fundamental math of the business," said Bannon. "We really ended up negotiating with his bankers, J.P. Morgan." The acquisition gave the firm a client roster that included Cameron Diaz, Leonardo DiCaprio, Ice Cube, and Limp Bizkit. "We were pirates, and Jeff was the king pirate, shocking Hollywood," said Bannon. Quatennens and Bannon had grand visions of a sprawling, vertically integrated business that would brand its A-list artist clients across a dizzying array of platforms. Not only recording and film, but also concerts, clothing, animation, video games, and television. Bannon was as effusive about clients such as the rapper-actor Ice Cube as he would later be about TV star politician Donald Trump. "It's the beginning of a revolution," Bannon declared with characteristic brio to an entertainment reporter for the Washington Post. "We're in the Vin Diesel business, or the Fred Durst business." Amid charges of cocaine use from ex-employees, which Quatennens denied, and unexplained absences, Quatennens eventually left the firm. Bannon didn't stick around for the revolution. By 2005, he had left Hollywood for the other side of the globe, Hong Kong, where he became involved in what was undoubtedly the strangest business of any in his kaleidoscopic career, one that introduced him to a hidden world, burrowed deep into his psyche, and provided a kind of conceptual framework that he would later draw on to build up the audience for Breitbart News, and then to help marshal the online armies of trolls and activists that overran national politics and helped give rise to Donald Trump. The business centered on a video game, World of Warcraft, a so-called massively multiplayer online role-playing game, MMO, whose 10 million subscribers competed against one another in the mythical realm of Azeroth, a fantasy world of elves, dwarfs, trolls, goblins, and dragons. Skilled players can win weapons, armor, and gold. These are, of course, virtual items acquired and used within the game. Yet ardent enthusiasts were willing to buy them for real money in the real world to help them conquer World of Warcraft and other MMOs, a practice known as real money trading. Soon, entrepreneurial gamers systematized the process of gold farming, earning tens or even hundreds of thousands of dollars a year by selling digital loot. The Hong Kong company Bannon joined, Internet Gaming Entertainment, sought to take gold farming to industrial scale by building out a supply chain of low-wage Chinese workers who played World of Warcraft in continuous, rotating shifts, battling monsters and dragons to produce a steady stream of virtual goods that IGE sold to gold-hungry gamers in the West. Founded by a former child actor, Brock Pierce, who starred in Disney's Mighty Ducks movies, IGE proved that real money trading was a sizable market, one the company claimed was worth nearly $1 billion. Whether it was a legal market was less clear. World of Warcraft's publisher, Blizzard Entertainment, frowned on real money trading. Many gamers hated the practice and considered it a form of cheating. They flooded gaming boards with anti-Chinese vitriol to protest farmers and their sponsors. Pierce knew IGE needed legitimacy, so he enlisted Bannon to raise capital, hoping game publishers would eventually agree to license the practice. Bannon pitched the idea that the currency market for virtual gold wasn't all that different from its real-world counterpart, and landed $60 million from Goldman Sachs and other investors. Their timing turned out to be terrible. Rather than agree to a licensing deal, Blizzard, under pressure from its customers, started shutting down the accounts of suspected gold farmers and sellers. Beset by competitors, IGE's profits turned to losses. Then the company was hit by a class-action lawsuit filed in U.S. District Court in Florida by an irate World of Warcraft fanatic who claimed that IGE's gold farming practices were substantially impairing the collective enjoyment of the game. In a bid to survive, IGE shed its toxic name, Pierce was forced out, and Bannon was installed as CEO of the newly christened Affinity Media. In a financial sense, the push to build a third-party business around selling virtual goods inside a video game was a disaster for almost everyone involved. Inevitably, game makers began selling goods directly to their players. Yet Bannon was captivated by what he had discovered while trying to build the business, an underworld he hadn't known existed that was populated by millions of intense young men. Most gamers were men, who disappeared for days or even weeks at a time in alternate realities. While perhaps not social adepts, they were smart, focused, relatively wealthy, and highly motivated about issues that mattered to them. Their collective might, powerful enough to wreck IGE's business and bend companies such as Blizzard to their will. As he would later confirm, this luciferous insight gave him an early understanding of the size and strength of online communities, along with an appreciation for the powerful currents that run just below the surface of the Internet. He began to wonder if those forces could be harnessed and, if so, how he might exploit them. Affinity sold off its gold farming operations to a competitor at a steep discount, but Bannon held on to a network of three large MMO gaming sites that the company had acquired: Wowhead, Alakazam, and Thoughtbot, that were the hubs where these gamers congregated by the millions. If you trace a line backward from Trump's election, it doesn't take long before you encounter online networks of motivated gamers and message board denizens, such as the ones who populate Trump-crazed boards like 4chan, 8chan, and Reddit. During the campaign, users of these message boards were eager purveyors of racist, alt-right invective, such as the anti-Semitic Pepe the Frog images that the Anti-Defamation League declared a hate symbol. Trace the line back a little further, and it leads to Breitbart News and Bannon, whose hiring of the anti-feminist internet troll Milo Yiannopoulos as Breitbart's tech editor in 2015 greatly exacerbated these forces. But Bannon's path would never have veered from Hollywood and pointed him in that direction had it not been for a tragedy that re-inflamed his antipathy toward Islam and his conviction that Western civilization was under attack. The September 11, 2001 terrorist attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon functioned as a kind of echo for Bannon of the 1979 seizure of American hostages at the U.S. Embassy in Tehran. The two decades in between, he realized, had done nothing to staunch the threat of radical Islam to the United States. In fact, Islamic terrorists had struck with greater force than anyone imagined they could, and had chosen as a target of their attack the very Wall Street financial district where he had long toiled for Goldman Sachs. The Iranian hostage crisis first impelled Bannon toward Ronald Reagan, whose strength, he was certain, was vital to preserving America's safety and influence in the world. Having long ago left the military, he didn't have any obvious outlet to respond to the new attacks. A middle-aged Hollywood investment banker can't exactly walk into a recruiter's office and re-enlist. But the following year, Bannon, an avid reader of biographies and political histories, picked up a new book, Reagan's War, the epic story of his 40-year struggle and final triumph over communism, by the conservative scholar Peter Schweitzer. Drawing on newly available archives, including Reagan's KGB file, Schweitzer drew a portrait of the president as he was seen by his enemies, arguing, rather effusively, that Reagan's steadfastness and foresight, along with his willingness to buck expert opinion, was almost single-handedly responsible for winning the Cold War. Working in Hollywood all these years, Bannon had plenty of up-close experience in the film business, but it was all on the financial side. He longed, like countless money men before him, to get involved on the creative side. Never wanting for ideas or conviction, he now had the means to indulge his passion. He optioned the film rights to Schweitzer's book and wrote and directed a movie based upon it, In the Face of Evil, 2004. It was really a metaphor, Bannon said of his film. It was just after 9/11, and I wanted to tell a story about how a democracy takes on a radical ideology. He persuaded Schweitzer to collaborate with him on the project. Peter and I worked on the film to tell the story of Reagan's 60-year struggle with communism, he said, and at the end, we we connect the dots about how that was like America's struggle with radical Islam. The film had a modest release and won glowing praise from conservative audiences. A brilliant effort. Extremely well done, said Rush Limbaugh. It won the Best Feature Film Award at the Liberty Film Festival, a new film festival meant to establish a conservative beachhead in liberal Hollywood. It was here that Bannon first encountered Andrew Breitbart, the conservative impresario, and was drawn into his orbit. We screened the film at a festival in Beverly Hills, Bannon recalled, and out of the crowd comes this, like, bear, who's squeezing me like my head's going to blow up, and saying how we've got to take back the culture. I didn't really know who he was. Breitbart, who also lived in Los Angeles, had an immediate and profound influence on Bannon. He became the kind of guru figure that the Maharishi was to the Beatles. When they met, Breitbart was just starting his eponymous website network, after having worked with Matt Drudge to publish the Drudge Report, and having helped Arianna Huffington launch the liberal Huffington Post. Breitbart was a character after Bannon's own heart, loud, opinionated, cocksure, gleefully combative, and possessed of performative gifts that Bannon could only envy. I'd never met a conservative who had this kind of huge persona, he recalled. Breitbart also shared a keen appreciation for, and a deep understanding of, online audiences and how to influence them. And not just audiences, but also the media outlets that catered to them. Bannon marveled at how Breitbart was able to shape media coverage through the Drudge Report, which was rapidly followed by television producers and news editors, and how he seemed to have a visceral feel for the news cycle. Breitbart also heightened his awareness of culture as an important front in the battle against secular liberalism, and the weakness that both men felt it instilled. Politics is downstream from culture, Breitbart liked to say. I want to change the cultural narrative. What this meant was that Breitbart was less interested in trying to influence Washington directly than he was in going after the institutions and the methods they employed, like political correctness, that he believed shaped this narrative. Bannon, recognizing a new pirate king, helped Breitbart build out his new endeavor, lending financial acumen and office space. He had direct experience with media-focused internet startups. I had looked over the shoulders of some of the private equity guys who had put the money into the Huffington Post, Bannon said. The one thing they told me to explain the huge valuation is that it was not a content play, but a technology play. They had Jonah Peretti, guy's a genius, who at the time was walking me through the tech side of the business and told me, "You're really not thinking about traffic. You're thinking about community." That always stuck in the back of my mind. The other thing Bannon gleaned from Breitbart was the exhilarating, galvanizing power of being the bad guy, publicly despised by those whom you profess to oppose. I realized I liked being hated more than I liked being liked. That's when the game began, Breitbart explained to Time in 2010. But where Breitbart's hatred of his enemies often had a twinkle, Bannon took a more literal view of his role in the opposition. Over the next several years, as Barack Obama was elected and the Tea Party backlash arrived, Bannon continued making and producing documentaries, big, crashing, opinionated films with Wagner scores and martial imagery. Border Wars, The Battle Over Illegal Immigration, 2006, on clashes at the U.S.-Mexico border. Battle for America, 2010, celebrating the rise of the Tea Party, and Generation Zero, 2010, examining the roots of the financial meltdown. By then he had become a full-blown populist critic of Wall Street. "Here's what changed," said Bannon. What Goldman represented in the 1980s was that they were principal providers of capital formation. It was all about fostering growth. Growth is good. If you went to Goldman when I did, the elite branch of the firm was investment banking, and the most elite was M&A. The traders were guys from Queens. They were just beginning the quant age. Bannon claimed he could no longer recognize the world he had known and the values it embraced, and he was repelled by the new one that had taken its place. He thought there was a cinematic poignancy to the transformation. It's like watching the movie Wall Street, when Charlie Sheen first walks into the trading room, he said, describing his younger self. Then, cut to 2008, when I come back from Asia, and investment banks had become highly leveraged hedge funds. That's where they make all the money, and they wrecked the economy. This is the standard populist critique of the financial crisis, routinely espoused by liberals and many conservatives alike. That Bannon's father lost a good part of his retirement savings gives it an especially personal gloss. But Bannon's diagnosis of the cause of the crisis is where he parts company with Michael Lewis and other mainstream critics of Wall Street. Generation Zero is a film suffused with Andrew Breitbart's influence. In it, Bannon blames liberal social policies for creating the culture of Wall Street permissiveness that ultimately led to the crash. By the late 90s, a narrator intones, the left had taken over many of the institutions of power, meaning government, media, and academe. And it was from these places and positions of power that they were able to disrupt the system and implement a strategy that was designed to ultimately undermine the capitalist system. As the 2010 midterm elections neared, Sarah Palin, still riding high from her star turn in the 2008 presidential campaign, approached Bannon to see if he would be interested in shooting videos for her. This struck Bannon as a near-perfect conjunction of timing, personality, and politics. Palin was the avatar of the Tea Party movement, a global phenomenon, and someone thought to be seriously considering a run for the presidency. Instead of just shooting video, Bannon made a full documentary movie about Palin, The Undefeated, 2011, on which he reportedly spent $1 million of his own money. He went all out. In the Bannon repertoire, no metaphor is too direct. The Undefeated is peppered with footage of lions attacking helpless gazelles and seedlings bursting from the ground into glorious bloom. Palin ate it up, and she traveled with her family to the first-in-the-nation caucus state of Iowa, trailed by hundreds of reporters, to appear with Bannon at a June premiere in Pella that the press thought might signal her entrance into the 2012 race. Before the curtain lifted, Bannon praised Palin's rough-hewn prairie populism. The hard-worn bricks outside the Pella Opera House are all the red carpet she needs. The atmosphere was charged. That same day, Palin's daughter, Bristol, told a TV reporter that her mother had made up her mind about a presidential run. Andrew Breitbart, who trekked to Pella to serve as ringmaster for the occasion, was as effusive in his praise of Bannon as he was Palin, remarking afterward that he considered Bannon to be the Leni Riefenstahl of the Tea Party movement. But Palin never took the plunge, and no other candidate struck quite the same chords. Instead, the locus of right-wing populism moved to the Internet, and to Breitbart News in particular. Most conservatives are individualists, Breitbart said. For years they've been pummeled by the collectivists who run the American media, Hollywood, and Washington. The underground conservative movement that is now awakening is the ecosystem I've designed my sights to tap into. One big draw of Breitbart's underground movement was his flair for showmanship, along with his embrace of stunt journalism, which occasionally broke through into the mainstream. Breitbart's signature maneuver was the elaborate trolling operation aimed at some liberal icon or institution that exposed the hypocrisy at the heart of its enterprise. His first hit came in 2009, when he posted video of an amateur sting operation run by two conservative activists, James O'Keefe and Hannah Giles, against the liberal community activist group Association of Community Organizations for Reform Now, ACORN, a favorite boogeyman of conservatives. In the video, O'Keefe appears to solicit and receive advice from the group on running a brothel. Subsequent investigations found that the videos had been manipulated in the editing process to make ACORN look complicit, but Congress suspended the group's funding anyway. The following year, Breitbart caused an even bigger uproar by posting video excerpts, once again furnished by a conservative activist, of a speech to the NAACP by a Department of Agriculture official named Shirley Sherrod. In the excerpts, Sherrod appeared to advocate anti-white racism. Within hours, she was fired, as the story blanketed cable news. But soon it became clear that the Breitbart News video was misleadingly edited, that Sherrod's point, as the full tape makes clear, had been the opposite of what was portrayed. Fox News, which aggressively promoted the Sherrod video, banned Andrew Breitbart as an on-air guest. By then, Bannon was actively involved in the site and its business. When the Sherrod story blew up, he was out raising money to expand and relaunch Breitbart News. With the negative publicity and the taint of racism, he suddenly encountered nuclear winter. And yet Breitbart himself was immune to shame, or at least to being shamed, and had no compunction about launching vicious personal attacks. Upon learning of Senator Ted Kennedy's death, Breitbart tweeted that Kennedy was a villain, a prick, and a duplicitous bastard, adding, "I'm more than willing to go off decorum to ensure this man is not beatified." The ostracizing of Breitbart News didn't last long. Less than a year later, the site caught Democratic Representative Anthony Weiner tweeting pictures of his genitals. According to Bannon, the site helped to orchestrate his downfall. Tipped to Weiner's proclivity for sexting with female admirers, he said, the site paid trackers to follow his Twitter account around the clock and eventually intercepted the fateful crotch shot Weiner inadvertently made public. As the journalist Greg Beato has documented at soundbitten.com, there is a fierce debate about who caught Anthony Weiner and on whose behalf that person was operating. Bannon told me in a 2015 interview that the site had used paid trackers. Beato notes that the person or persons behind the Twitter account at PatriotUSA76 initially spotted and shared Weiner's career-ending genital tweeting misfortune. That person claims his name is Dan Wolf, but his identity has never been independently verified. Andrew Breitbart maintained that he'd never had any contact with at PatriotUSA76 before Weiner's tweet and never learned his true identity. As if orchestrated by some higher power, the ensuing scandal culminated in the surreal scene, carried live on television, of Breitbart hijacking Weiner's New York press conference and fielding questions from astonished reporters. He was quickly welcomed back to Fox News. The experience taught Bannon the power of real news and how it could be exploited, a lesson he would soon have cause to put into practice. On March 1, 2012, with the relaunch of Breitbart News just 4 days away, Bannon was in New York City pitching investors when he got a phone call. Andrew Breitbart had been walking in his Brentwood neighborhood that morning when he collapsed and died of heart failure. He was 43. Feeling shell-shocked and duty-bound, Bannon made the decision to formally join Breitbart News, stepping in to become its executive chairman. At the funeral, Matt Drudge asked Bannon what he planned to do. Bannon replied, "We're going ahead with the launch." 5. Nobody builds walls like Trump. Trump had been thinking about running for president for more than 20 years before he encountered Steve Bannon. During most of that period, they were not ideologically aligned. Trump did have long-standing impulses on certain issues that Bannon would have approved of. Both believed, for instance, that the United States was constantly being victimized in foreign trade deals. But to the extent Trump expressed opinions on national affairs, they tended to reflect the views of a New York Democrat, which was, after all, the world that he inhabited. Then he met Bannon, and his views changed. Trump took up Bannon's populist nationalism, with its chesty blue-collar ethos and disdain for corrupt globalist elites. But just as important to Trump's path to the White House was what he chose to give up. On January 8, 2004, viewers of NBC's primetime television lineup got the first glimpse of a new show soon to become a cultural sensation. As a crow's-eye view of the Manhattan skyline floated across the screen, Donald Trump's unmistakable voice, all steely self-confidence, laid out the premise of his new series. "New York, my city, where the wheels of the global economy never stop turning. The perspective jumps to the backseat of a limousine and a familiar figure. My name is Donald Trump, and I'm the largest real estate developer in New York. I own buildings all over the place, model agencies, the Miss Universe pageant, jetliners, golf courses, casinos. As he climbs out of the limousine toward a Trump-emblazoned helicopter that awaits him, Trump delivers the payoff. I've mastered the art of the deal, and I've turned the name Trump into the highest quality brand. As the master, I want to pass along my knowledge to somebody else. I'm looking for The Apprentice. Right out of the gate, The Apprentice was a hit. During its first season, the show drew an average of more than 20 million viewers a week. It was the dawn of the reality TV era, and Trump's cartoonish persona lent itself perfectly to the new medium. Each week, Trump would preside from a luxe, walnut-lined boardroom high up in Trump Tower. Actually, the boardroom wasn't high up in Trump Tower. This was an illusion created by the show's producers, who interspersed footage of the nervous contestants riding up in an elevator at the end of every episode, before Trump's judgment was meted out. The boardroom used in the show was located on the fifth floor of Trump Tower, space that, as mentioned, was later gutted to serve as Trump's early campaign headquarters and housed the crack den on election night. As 16 contestants competed against one another by running business projects, after which they would all assemble in the boardroom and submit themselves to Trump's glowering judgment. Each week at the end of the show, Trump would dispatch one of the contestants with his signature phrase, "You're fired!" NBC executives were thrilled by the surprise hit on their hands. Until The Apprentice, the network had not managed to develop a successful reality TV franchise, and it was falling behind its major competitors, CBS, Survivor, Big Brother, and ABC, The Mole. Trump's success was all the more important to NBC because the show aired in a critical time slot, Thursday primetime, that for years had boasted a powerhouse lineup, most recently anchored by the ensemble comedy Friends. But by the spring of 2004, Friends was finishing up its final season. To NBC's great relief, The Apprentice reached out and took the baton. The show's fast success produced significant economic benefits for the network. It did so for Trump, too. But it also did something more. It indelibly established his national image. Mark Burnett, the show's creator, had originally sold the concept to NBC as one where Trump would host The Apprentice for only the first season, after which he would give way to a succession of iconic business moguls, such as Richard Branson, Mark Cuban, or Martha Stewart. That idea quickly fell by the wayside. After the first episode, recalled Jeff Gaspin, who ran reality programming for NBC, we said, "We want more Trump." Trump's power to draw a mass audience during prime time was also vital to NBC, because by the mid-2000s, all of the major networks were beginning to lose audience share to cable television and other outlets. The fact that Trump could reliably hold huge swaths of viewers made it easy for NBC to line up major advertisers, and line them up it did. McDonald's, Pepsi, Home Depot, Visa, Ford, Capital One, Kellogg's, Panasonic, and many other blue-chip corporations advertised during The Apprentice, several of them continuing to do so for the show's entire decade-long run. The fact that Trump's 20 million viewers were tuning in on Thursday nights also made The Apprentice the perfect destination for Hollywood studios, keen to advertise the new films they would be debuting over the weekend. But there was an additional aspect of Trump's appeal that received almost no mainstream media attention at all, and yet it was a key part of why advertisers found his show so desirable, and why Trump, even though he was politically dormant during this period, managed to build a national profile that was dramatically different from any other major Republican figure, then or since. Trump was extremely popular with minority audiences. Because The Apprentice drew a mass audience that pulled in an especially high proportion of African-American and Hispanic viewers, Fortune 500 companies seeking to reach these particular demographics could advertise on the show and get the best of both worlds, First and foremost, advertisers are buying the absolute number, and he got really good numbers, said Eric Leininger, who was chief marketing officer at McDonald's in 2004. Secondly, they're buying against particular demographics, and it's easier for a company like McDonald's to buy a program that has a big audience, as opposed to having to aggregate an audience by buying five smaller ones. If you can have a mass program that brings you a diverse audience, that's a beautiful thing. Furthermore, it quickly became apparent that the appeal of The Apprentice to minority audiences was rooted not just in the manufactured drama of a business competition, but in Trump himself and the world he projected on his show. As an active marketer watching the show, the beautiful thing about The Apprentice was that it was a wonderfully integrated program, said Monique Nelson, chief executive officer of Uniworld, an advertising agency focused on minority audiences with two clients, Home Depot and Ford, that advertised on The Apprentice. There were always people of color, women, people from all different backgrounds, so it connects. The one thing we know about marketing is that when you see a character that reminds you of yourself, you get invested. What's more, Trump and the show's creators featured their minority contestants in a role that departed from how minority characters were historically portrayed on television and in movies. The Apprentice presented them as striving, ambitious entrepreneurs. Although she was fired from the show in week 9, Omarosa Manigault Stallworth, an African-American graduate student at Howard University who had held a low-level White House job for Vice President Al Gore, was the breakout star of The Apprentice's debut season, styling herself into what remains the epitome of the reality TV villain. In the show's fourth season, which aired in the fall of 2005, Randall D. Pinkett, an African-American business consultant and a Rhodes Scholar, won the overall title and became The Apprentice. People noticed. They did a wonderful